Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Boniface of the group Free Speech for People, who explains why he believes new revelations about President Trump's pressure on Ukraine's president to aid his re-election campaign adds momentum to an already strong case for impeachment. Mel Goodman, a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy, who assesses the Trump regime's response to the September 14th drone attack on Saudi Arabia's oil infrastructure. And Jan Hasselman, staff attorney with Earth Justice, who talks about the ongoing legal and political struggle to shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to a new United Nations fact-finding mission, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims who remain in Myanmar now face the ongoing threat of genocide. 600,000 Rohingya live in deplorable conditions in Myanmar's Rakhine State and are subject to severe restrictions on their movement, employment, and education. Yang He Lee, a special UN rapporteur for Myanmar, accuses Myanmar's government of doing nothing to dismantle the systems of violence and repression against the Rohingya. A recent attempt to repatriate Rohingya back to Myanmar collapsed after refugees in Bangladesh refused to return, citing a lack of accountability for atrocities committed by the nation's military. During the summer of 2017, Myanmar security forces launched assaults on Rohingya villages in response to insurgent attacks on police posts. The army, which has been accused of engaging in massacres, gang rape, and arson, forced 750,000 Rohingya to flee to neighboring Bangladesh. A report by the Australian Security Policy Institute estimates 40% of Rohingya villages damaged in the 2017 violence were totally demolished, and in some cases are now being used as government relocation camps. On a typical evening in the United States, 500,000 people are homeless, while millions more cannot access rental assistance. In cities across the nation, a minimum wage worker would have to work 3 full-time jobs to afford a typical 2-bedroom apartment. While states like California are pushing for protections for vulnerable tenants, community activists are moving for a dramatic transformation of federal housing policy, which could lead to the development of 12 million social housing units over the next decade. The plan calls for investing billions of dollars to upgrade existing public housing units and providing relief to those who lost their housing to the predatory lending practices and mortgage fraud that led to the 2008 financial crash over a decade ago. The plan, called a National Homes Guarantee, was crafted by People's Action, a national progressive coalition of 48 grassroots member organizations. Progressive presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have embraced aspects of the Homes Guarantee plan, which also links new affordable housing investment with clean energy retrofits and measures to address decades of racist housing policies. According to In These Times magazine, the plan goes beyond most reforms by recognizing that private developers and landlords do not have the capacity or economic incentive to provide housing for all. 2020 presidential candidate Kamala Harris does not present herself as a foreign policy candidate, but she has close ties with Middle East hawks and hardliners on North Korea, which has caused concern among many progressive Democratic Party activists. Harris, a first-term Democratic senator from California, has close ties with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and has been reluctant to co-sponsor key pieces of legislation aimed at preventing future U.S. wars with Venezuela and North Korea. While Harris has co-sponsored a bill opposing U.S. support for Saudi Arabia in its brutal war in Yemen, she has declared that the Saudis remain an important U.S. ally in areas such as counterterrorism. On issues of militarism, she's often in line with, and sometimes to the right of, the Democratic Party's hawkish establishment. Unlike her history as a law and order California prosecutor who drafted and enforced harsh truancy laws, Senator Harris's foreign policy record has not attracted much attention. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
Following a week of revelations regarding a whistleblower complaint against President Trump for allegedly pressuring Ukraine President Zelensky to produce incriminating evidence against former Vice President and current Democratic White House candidate Joe Biden's son Hunter, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced the House is launching a formal impeachment inquiry against the president. Reports indicate that Trump improperly used his position as U.S. President on multiple occasions to compel the Ukrainian president to investigate Vice President Joe Biden's son Hunter's position on the board of the country's largest gas company, Burisma, by withholding U.S. military aid until he agreed. Although the House issued a subpoena to obtain the whistleblower complaint, Acting Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire blocked Congress from receiving the complaint. Now the whistleblower who filed the complaint wants to testify before the House Intelligence Committee. Your reporter spoke with John Bonifaz, co-founder of the group Free Speech for People, who explains why he believes these new revelations about President Trump's pressure on Ukraine adds momentum to an already strong case for impeachment.
The most important thing that American people need to know is that this president in the Oval Office is actively soliciting a foreign power to assist in his reelection campaign, which is a high crime, clearly an impeachable offense. And this is after, of course, a lengthy investigation into the role that the Russian government played in assisting him with his willing acceptance of that assistance for his election in 2016. Now we have, after all that, this president doing it again, but this time as president of the United States. And then the additional information that's critical is that there are reports that he may have withheld $250 million in aid that Congress had approved and authorized for the Ukraine and had done so as a form of bribery and or extortion to get that assistance he wanted for his personal interests in his reelection campaign. All of this is a clearly impeachable behavior. And it is why Congress needs to move swiftly to get the whistleblower complaint that has emerged. But if it doesn't get that whistleblower complaint, to move forward with impeachment articles against this president on this basis alone.
What is the power of the Judiciary Committee to move things forward? And repeat, if you would, the deadlines that you think are important to put down as a marker immediately.
Yes. The House Judiciary Committee is where impeachment processes begin. They are empowered to start an impeachment inquiry, as they have now done. And the vote that they took on September 12th was a procedural vote to set out the processes by which they would engage in questioning witnesses and involving staff members in the questioning of witnesses and other items included in that resolution. And so it's been formalized through that vote that there is an impeachment inquiry underway. But the problem is that the House Judiciary Committee has had overwhelming evidence of this president's high crimes for many months now. The Mueller report was delivered to them in late April. It took 4 months from the time of materials delivered from the Watergate prosecution to the House Judiciary Committee in February of 1974, to the vote in July of 1974 of the House Judiciary Committee on articles of impeachment against then Richard Nixon. It took 3 months approximately from the Starr report being presented to Congress for the House Judiciary Committee to vote out articles of impeachment against then-President Clinton. So the House Judiciary Committee has had more than enough time to look at the evidence before it, and even before the Mueller report came out, there was overwhelming evidence of this president's high crimes, including the emoluments violations that began on day one of this presidency. And the deadline is crucial because there are many within the camp who are trying to stop this impeachment process who suggest that we should just impeach him at the ballot. There is no such thing as impeaching at the ballot. The framers designed the impeachment clause specifically to deal with an official of the government, such as the president, who posed a direct and serious threat to the republic. And this president, on a nearly daily basis, attacks our Constitution, attacks our democracy, and attacks the rule of law. He is a present and direct threat to our republic, and he needs to face accountability through the impeachment process. We don't wait for elections to address that kind of constitutional crisis. We address it through the impeachment proceedings.
John, this most recent whistleblower complaint that has been leaked into the press is often spoken of as a smoking gun that will be a slam dunk for those who advocate impeachment. What is your view of the facts as we know it right now? And we don't know all the facts about this whistleblower and the complaint about attempting to extort dirt on presidential candidate, former Vice President Joe Biden and his son, pressuring the Ukrainian government by threatening to withhold aid to Ukraine. What is it that this particular set of facts tells us to date about how that would figure in with impeachment?
Well, I think we first have to address what we already know that's in the public record and what the president himself has already admitted, and that is that he discussed this matter dealing with Joe Biden and his son with the president of the Ukraine. His lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has gone on television also admitting to that they did in fact seek the assistance of the Ukrainian government. So separate and apart from whether there was bribery or extortion, we already have open admissions by the president and his private attorney, Rudy Giuliani, that this is in fact what they did, that they solicited illegal foreign assistance for the presidential reelection campaign.
That was John Bonifaz, co-founder of the group Free Speech for People, and co-author of the book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Find more analysis and commentary on the House move toward impeaching Donald Trump by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The September 14th drone and missile attack on two of Saudi Arabia's major oil infrastructure facilities triggered an escalation of already high tensions in the region. Houthi rebels operating out of neighboring Yemen initially took credit for launching the drone attack, which crippled more than half of the Saudis' oil output, 5% of the global oil supply. But the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, later joined by Britain, France, and Germany, have accused the Houthi forces of falsely claiming to have carried out the Saudi attack to cover up the role Tehran allegedly played in orchestrating the sophisticated airstrike, an accusation that Iran and the Houthis have denied. But there appears to be division within the ranks of the Houthis over how closely to align with Iran. On September 20th, the Houthis offered a unilateral ceasefire, and the Wall Street Journal reported that some Houthi militants have warned foreign diplomats that Iran is now preparing another attack on Saudi Arabia. Thus far, President Trump has not ordered U.S. military action, but imposed new sanctions on Iran's central bank. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, adjunct professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University, and author, who assesses the Trump regime's response to the drone attack on Saudi oil infrastructure as he links rising regional tensions to Trump's 2018 unilateral withdrawal from the international nuclear agreement with Iran.
Well, the Houthis claim responsibility initially. They're no longer claiming responsibility. And what I find interesting about the Houthis is now they're offering to Saudi Arabia to get into discussions to halt the artillery and missile attacks particularly the artillery and missile attacks of Saudi Arabia on Yemen, but also the Houthi attacks on Saudi Arabia. So I don't think the Houthis had anything to do with this attack that only Iran could have orchestrated. Intelligence sources I've talked to said the missiles didn't come from the south. They didn't come from Yemen. They came from the north. And what is also interesting about this attack is it was extremely sophisticated. There were 20 drone aircraft and cruise missiles. Only one missed its target. And I'm told they came from multiple locations. So I assume some may have come from Shia areas in Iraq, where the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has been active, and possibly from Iran itself, but not from Yemen, not from the Houthis. And I would think in terms of what Iran has orchestrated here, it's part of their response to the maximum pressure that the United States keeps talking about. It's Iran's way of saying, you know, we can apply maximum pressure as well. So if you go back to June, when they downed the drone, and then the interference with tankers in the region and attacks we've seen on the pipeline in Saudi Arabia, and now this sophisticated attack on the oil production facilities, Iran has sort of told Donald Trump that, okay, you created this crisis, you own this crisis, you started this crisis, but it's not like we don't have weapons to deal with this problem. And it's clear that Donald Trump does not want to use military force. You have to go back to June when the military was prepared to go, and with 10 minutes left before the strike was supposed to take place, all of the naval instruments were in place. Donald Trump called off the attack, saying once he learned about the fact that there might be 150 civilian casualties, he decided this was not proportional and he wasn't going to use military force.
Mel, as you said, if the evidence points to Iran orchestrating this attack on the Saudi oil facilities, wasn't the Iranian government taking a huge risk there in that there's been so much bellicose rhetoric going back and forth between Washington and Riyadh and Tehran that this could have set off and maybe still will set off some horrific war between Iran, the Gulf states, with the U.S. involvement? Why take such a risk?
Well, one, I don't think they're worried about the Gulf states. They're certainly not worried about Saudi Arabia. In fact, what this attack exposed was all of the shortcomings of the Saudi military. They've been involved in this disaster in Yemen, this terrible humanitarian crisis now for about 5 years. Their military is quite suspect. Their officers are really people who have family connections. It's a classic case of nepotism when you look at the highest levels of the Saudi military. There really is no enlisted force to speak of. And when you talk about war and the use of military as an instrument, you rely on your enlisted people. The Saudi Air Force, I think, needs training wheels, and the United States Air Force are those training wheels. So the concern is not with Saudi Arabia or the Gulf states, but you're right. They had to calculate that Donald Trump was a classic bully, that he was all bluster, that they were going to apply their own campaign of maximum pressure. And I think you're right. It was risky to hit the Saudi production capabilities in a significant way, but they felt they still had cards to play given the vulnerability of U.S. forces in Iraq, where the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is also present, and also the vulnerability of a very small number of American forces in Syria.
Mel, with the walls closing in on Donald Trump with his most recent scandal, is there a danger that Donald Trump could take military action against Iran to distract the public from this latest scandal, which seems quite serious in its scope and with possible repercussions of driving the House to push aggressively for impeachment?
Well, I've been worried about Trump right along from the very beginning that at some point he's going to realize that the one way to rally support for his presidency and his administration and his inept leadership is to use military power, which in this country always rallies around the flag. There's always the possibility he'll wake up one morning and decide that this is the morning when I'm going to unleash military forces.
That was Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, adjunct professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University, and author. His most recent books are American Carnage, The Wars of Donald Trump, and A Whistleblower at the CIA, The Path of Dissent. For more perspectives on the drone attack on Saudi oil infrastructure, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In 2016, indigenous people from around the world and their allies came together in North Dakota in a historic fight to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline from being built across the unceded territory of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation. The tribe feared their water source, the Missouri River, would be contaminated by the pipeline if and when a spill occurred. When Donald Trump became president, his first official act was approving the pipeline. Fast forward to 2019, when Energy Transfer Partners, the company that built the pipeline, announced plans to double the volume of crude oil flowing through the pipeline from western North Dakota. The law firm Earth Justice has represented the tribe in its previous and ongoing legal efforts to shut down the pipeline, winning some decisions and losing others. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jan Hasselman, the Earth Justice attorney on the case. Here he summarizes what's happened up to now and the tribe's ongoing effort to shut down the pipeline and winning justice.
In December of 2016, the Obama administration effectively denied the permits for the pipeline to cross the Missouri River and ordered a full environmental impact statement that looked at alternative routings, looked at the potential impacts of the pipeline on the tribe's treaty rights. And that was a huge victory for Indian country because the pipeline at that point was almost completely built except for the short span across the Missouri River. As everyone knows, on his second full day in office, Trump reversed that order and directed the permits to be issued. The pipeline was complete by June of that year. So as soon as the Trump permits were issued, we went back to court. We won our lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers. The court found that the environmental analysis was insufficient, important respects that all had to do with the tribe. He ordered them to redo their environmental analysis. He had a separate round of briefing on whether the pipeline should be shut down in the interim, and he ultimately answered that question in the negative for now. So the pipeline has continued to operate since that time. The Army Corps went back and redid its environmental analysis, and to the surprise of absolutely no one, came up with the conclusion that it did a terrific job the first time and nothing needed to change. The process, in the tribe's view, was a sham. They never seriously looked at the risk of spills on the tribe's culture and economy and way of life. The tribe was completely shut out of the process. There was never any kind of good faith dialogue or exchange of information. So we're back in court. We've renewed our lawsuit and have asked the judge to shut down the pipeline again. That briefing is ongoing. We expect a decision probably early next year. In the meantime, the whole issue of the pipeline is back in the news as some of the 2020 candidates have pledged to shut the pipeline down if they are elected. And that's the right thing to do. The Obama administration had it right. This needed more thought, more consideration, and consultation with the Standing Rock Sioux and other affected tribes. So whether we are in a court process or in a political process, this issue has not gone away, and it's not going to go away.
Jan Hasselman, I know there have been some small spills in the Dakota Access Pipeline since it went online in 2017, but they were all on land, not in the Missouri River.
You know, as far as the Missouri goes, the pipeline is 90 feet under the bed of the river. And so we're not going to know about a spill until it's already too late, until it's a catastrophe. There's no technology in place that would monitor or alert us to a slow leak or something like that in the pipeline. We'll know that there's been a spill when there's oil on the surface of the Missouri River, and by then you've got a disaster on your hands. The other thing that is relevant here is that ETP has the worst safety record in the industry by a mile. They have a terrible record of spills, disasters, non-compliance with permits and environmental regulations. In fact, they are being investigated at a criminal level in Pennsylvania because of the number of violations and mistakes that have happened on another pipeline, Mariner East 3, in that state. So these are not people that should be operating anything of importance, and certainly not a crude oil pipeline carrying 500,000 barrels a day under one of the nation's most important waterways.
What can you tell us about Energy Transfer's plan to double the amount of oil flowing through the pipeline?
The proposal, as I understand it, is to build some additional pumping stations along the pipeline's length, but otherwise it wouldn't change the pipeline itself. So you're basically putting twice as much oil into the same confined space. And our technical experts think that this is an incredibly bad idea, at least without a very careful analysis of what it means, what kind of safety systems are in place, how do we make sure that spills aren't occurring.
Do you think there is any realistic chance of stopping the pipeline from continuing to operate at all?
It is in the realm of possibility, and here's why. If you remember back to the beginning of this story, Trump authorized the pipeline with a stroke of a pen and issued an executive order that the Army Corps should issue the permits. And that authorization can be taken away with the same stroke of a pen. A President Warren or President Booker or any one of them could issue an order on their first day directing the Army Corps to revoke the permits. And that is completely within their legal authorization. The federal law gives agencies a fairly wide sweep of discretion to consider the public interest and the impacts on tribes in particular in making these kinds of decisions. So many of the major candidates for the presidency have pledged to do so. We look forward to holding them to that promise when they are elected.
That was Jan Hasselman, staff attorney with the law firm Earth Justice. Learn more about the continuing struggle to shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WAPP in Athens, Georgia, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.